Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And on this consequential election day, we have the latest episode in our This American Moment series. We're talking with artists and activists, religious leaders, writers, and big thinkers about the long view, where we are at this moment in American life and what it says about who we are. I'm also asking each guest to reflect on how they find a sense of balance and clarity in such a clamorous world. Siddharth Roy brings a scientific perspective to those questions. He was a PhD graduate student in civil engineering when the citizens of Flint, Michigan began complaining about their water. They were told by state and city leaders that the water was safe. I'll let Mr. Roy pick up the story from there. Siddharth Roy, welcome to the show. Really good to have you as part of our This American Moment series. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie, for having me.
You were in grad school in the summer of 2015 when you heard what the citizens of Flint were saying about their water. How did the news travel to you? What did you think?
Well, it's the most unlikely course of events, if you will. I, like many other graduate students here at Tech, you know, we were doing the grad school life. We were going to classes, doing research, working on assignments. And Mark Edwards, who's my PI, he's a professor. He specializes in water contamination and water chemistry and microbiology. So at the time, when Flint made the switch to the Flint River in April of 2014, and residents started experiencing health issues, the water turned brown, there were all these, you know, red flags, and the city and the state officials kept insisting everything was fine. There was a Flint mother, Miss Leanne Walters, who, you know, was really concerned about the health of her kids. She figured out that one of her twins had been lead poisoned, and she couldn't pinpoint the source. Looking for answers, you know, she asked the city and the state, and they said, you know, everything's fine. But when one of the tests that the city did at her house found high levels of lead, she really grew concerned, and she was like, I have to figure it out. I have to get to the bottom of this. So she started looking up, you know, official scientists who do this sort of thing. And she found, you know, first off, she found a scientist at EPA, Miguel del Toro, and he put Leanne in touch with us so that, you know, we could start sampling and get a sense of what really was going on. So that was how, you know, we got started on this journey. A mother concerned about the health of her kids looked up people online and found us.
As you got involved in this, you were aware that there were scientists in Flint, Michigan telling people that were concerned about the water, no, it's nothing to be worried about. We've done the tests. There were assurances that this was safe. So you knew that you were coming into an environment where citizens wanted to believe the scientists, and some scientists were telling them things that were not true.
Exactly. I mean, you have a whole system set up in place. You have civil servants who are people in my profession with my degrees, with my line of expertise, who are at these positions, you know, at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, MDEQ, that oversees Flint's water supply. And if they and, you know, the emergency managers of the state of Michigan who were in charge of Flint, if every one of these officials was at these, you know, public meetings and assuring people the water looks brown, but believe me, it's safe to drink. It's a big question mark. So you're right. We at the time realized that if there was a genuine problem, and Miguel, with the help of Leanne, figured out, well, it was Leanne, actually. This is the most mind-boggling part. A mother figured out that the city was not treating the water properly. And when she told us that, we knew that the public assurances were probably false. But remember, we are scientists. We have to get to the truth first before we can make assertions. So we reached out to MDEQ. We reached out to officials saying, hey, listen, we have citizens calling us, and we'll be coming into town, and we'll be testing side by side, just so you know, and we'll share everything we find. So at the time, we wanted to be collaborative and open and get to the bottom of the truth.
What do you think the reaction was from the Michigan people who are hearing that these Virginia Tech researchers and scientists are coming in to do this sampling? I mean, did they see you for the threat that you would eventually become in the beginning?
Oh, well, early on, obviously, I don't think they knew how incompetent they were.
What?
To be very honest.
Really?
So here, I'll give you an example. So Miguel, when he was working with Leanne, he grew concerned that, you know, a city like Flint, an old city with lead pipes, should have what's called corrosion control treatment. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, millions of lead pipes across the country, and the way we control lead release is we control the water chemistry, we add a chemical sometimes so that, you know, lead levels stay low. So Miguel grew concerned and wrote to MDEQ, guys, you know, what kind of, do you have corrosion control? And they said yes. 2 months later, he came back and he's like, so what kind of corrosion control? And they said, oh, sorry, there is no corrosion control. And when Miguel released his memo with all this information from Leanne's house and you know, stating clearly that from a public health standpoint, not having corrosion control is a threat, the MDEQ, you know, said that he's a rogue employee, told people to relax. So if a scientific regulatory agency behaves in this fashion, does not engage with the science of what's being put forward, but, you know, does ad hominem attacks. I think when we arrived, we expected some of this, but not to the extent that we actually saw.
Is it true, and maybe it was the same agency, the Environmental Quality Department, is it true that they mocked you and your team and called you lead magicians, as if you were making this up out of thin air? Is that right?
Well, it's actually true. The person in charge of communications at MDEQ, a man named Brad Werfel, when he was asked about, so, you know, late August, citizens are doing the citywide sampling with our help. They knocked on so many doors across the city. They got back like 270 kits in a span of 4 weeks. Imagine doing a citywide sampling, driving around town, working 16-hour days voluntarily because you want answers to these very important questions. And so when we are releasing these results, local Michigan media approaches MDEQ and goes, so what do you think of these Virginia Tech results that Flint residents are collecting lead and they're finding high lead? And and Brad Werfel goes, well, the VT team specializes in looking for lead in water problems. They pull that a rabbit out of like every hat that every city they go to, they pull that rabbit out of the hat. I'm like, wow. So, Carrie, if you want some lead magic, just give me a call. I'd be happy to find some lead in your house.
What he was really suggesting is that this is your specialty, and you find lead everywhere you go because your science is wrong, right? You're skewed and biased towards finding lead, and that you weren't using objective results.
That is correct.
This is why I think your experience and you are a perfect person for our series, because in this American moment, science is diminished. I think Americans who maybe don't have the time or the interest to understand some complicated science are willing to listen to not very good evidence-based debates on either side. I mean, what you went through really speaks to, I think, where we are right now with scientific evidence. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I was looking up Pew polls over the past 40, 50 years to get a sense of how science is perceived in this country. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, science is the one public institution that is still widely respected. I think the issue is you are somewhat partisan in what you choose to believe. So to give you an example, I'll go back to Flint because that is what I know. When the issue came to light and there were congressional hearings, you had all the Democrats attacking the Michigan DEQ because Michigan has a Republican governor. And you had the Republicans attacking EPA because, you know, EPA had all the opportunity to arrive way before they actually did. They actually silenced Miguel when he spoke out and his memo got leaked. So, you know, EPA and MDEQ are both responsible for the debacle in Flint. But you had the Republicans attacking EPA because it was Obama's EPA. Mm-hmm. So, and there are studies substantiating this, that if, you know, you are more likely to believe people from, you know, your team, your tribe, about even issues that are not political. So to give you a scientific example, you have, you know, when people reject climate change, it's a lot of it is from the right, but you have very educated, you know, people on the left who reject vaccines. So it's a really bizarre thing to see and witness today.
We were talking about this yesterday in the newsroom, and we were saying that this is part of the reason that scientists themselves may hesitate to bring their research, to bring their evidence-based results into a sphere that is seen as political. I don't think, I understand that can be difficult. Maybe you put some of your funding at risk. Maybe you get swept into a political debate that you don't really want to be a part of. And yet the other side of that is scientists step out and just occupy their scientific bubble, and the public at large doesn't learn. So mm-hmm. Where do you come down on that? I mean, you got involved in something that ended up being political, but your work was not political.
Well, that is correct. So two things. First off, you know, I know so many scientists and engineers who are doing important work that has, you know, political relevance, that has relevance to society, but they're hesitant to speak out because of the backlash, because of the attacks that are, you know, that are coming. I mean, who would want to get involved in something that is so distasteful? You get attacked on social media, you're called names. So you really have that going against you. But the question is, for us at least, it was, do we sit on the side and watch this happen if we know for sure that public health is being hurt? And the answer is simply no. We have an ethical, we have a moral obligation to stand up and talk about issues that we from, you know, we have the evidence to prove is causing problems, is causing health issues. On the other side, you have many scientists, and this is the reality of the academic world today, where the focus is too much on metrics, on numbers, on how many papers you publish, on how many dollars you, how many, you know, funding dollars you bring in. So scientists, you know, they get on this treadmill, this hedonistic treadmill, where their focus is on these numbers and, you know, churning out papers, as opposed to really, really, you know, working on important issues that benefit society. So it's interesting to watch that, you know, you have people who step out and who do the right thing and get called names, but then there are many others who just want to keep their head down and rise up in their field.
Siddharth Roy is our guest for our newest episode in our This American Moment series, in which we're talking with activists and artists and scientists and religious leaders and big thinkers about the long view, where we are at this moment in America and what it says about who we are. I'm also asking every one of our guests for the series, which started sometime in mid-October, talked to a number of people for this, about how they maintain a moral compass, a sense of clarity as well, in a world that really feels chaotic and complex. So I'll be asking Siddharth about that as well. He's a research scientist in civil engineering at Virginia Tech, and one of the scientists who went to Flint, Michigan, and played a key role in understanding what was happening with the contamination of Flint's water. One of the things that I think is curious is what happens when people go into a field where They're a civil servant. They are there. Their understanding is that part of the job is to serve the public and serve their fellow citizens. And they abrogate that duty. I mean, this doesn't just happen in science. This happens in a lot of disciplines. Uh-huh. But what do they tell themselves about the ends justifying the means? I wondered if you had a glimpse into that kind of thinking when it comes to what was happening in Flint.
Well, 15 people have been criminally indicted from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Health Department and the City of Flint for their role in what's arguably one of the most egregious environmental injustices of our time. When you look at these criminal investigations and you look at emails that we uncovered with the help of ACLU Michigan through Freedom of Information Act requests, what emerges is a culture primarily that is more focused on meeting regulations as opposed to, you know, protecting public health. I'm not saying that's true for civil servants, period. It's true for a small minority, definitely. And so, to give you an example again, if Flint, the way Flint actually met the law, the reason scientists could claim that Flint was meeting all federal standards was because they had cheated on the law. They had found ways, they had gone into homes where with newer plumbing, where they knew that there will not be any lead in the water. Mm-hmm. They had asked homeowners to flush their lines the night before, so when they take a sample in the morning, the lead would be lower. And despite all of this, they actually, you know, failed the law, and then they dropped two samples from, including Leanne's, by the way, to meet the law. So you have an overt focus on ticking boxes, or at least in 2015, that was really the case, where you meet the regulations because if you don't, you have to do a lot of things. You have to tell people the water is not safe. You have to replace lead pipes. You have to do a whole host of things. So I think you don't need a profit motive to not do your job, and that is what was truly scary about what we witnessed in Flint.
I was just going to say, but the calculus, you've put it really well, the calculus of doesn't begin with, I'm going to hide this because I don't care that it's dangerous to people. I think it's a slow kind of chipping away at an ethic, and that brings you to a place that in hindsight looks like a complete abrogation of your duty and criminal activity. But I don't think it starts out that way. Have you mm-hmm. given some thought to that?
I agree. I mean, no one wakes up in the morning thinking I'll poison some kids today.
Right, right.
You're right. It starts off with one small, I'll just kind of tick this box and fudge some numbers here a little bit. And that is what happened in Flint. This sometimes happens in science. This happened even in the lead crisis in Washington, D.C. in the early 2000s. A lot of people don't know this, but D.C. Witnessed one of the worst lead water disasters in U.S. history, where over 40,000 children were exposed to lead in the water for 3 years. Wow. And the CDC and EPA actually, hid the entire problem, covered it up. It took 6 years of dogged research and reporting to show that kids were actually hurt and, a lot of public health damage was done. So in that case, you have the power capital of the world, and this is going on in that city, and you have agencies that are paid to protect us, you're doing the exact opposite just so that they could, meet the law and get away with things. And they did. They got away in D.C.
It's a really good example. We had a call from Craig who is curious about the numbers. He wants to know, can you tell us what amount of lead in water was deemed legal in Flint or safe? And how did they compare with what you found?
Right. So to give you context, there is no safe level of lead. So zero parts per billion or ppb. Zero ppb is ideal, but because in the U.S. Has a lot of old plumbing infrastructure, a lot of the building was done in the 1800s and early 1900s, so we have a lot of lead pipes. So you will always find some lead. So the way the regulations work is if you find lead above 15 ppb in over 10% homes. So take, it's a little complicated, but I'll explain.
Okay.
So say, for example, you test 100 homes and 11 homes have lead above 15. So that's a violation. But 15 is a regulatory number. It has no health-based, mark. So we found that in our case, the 15 was 28. So it was way high. And in some homes, lead levels were in the hundreds. In Leanne's home, lead was in the thousands. It was just scary to witness. The highest sample we saw, and this really blew our mind. We had to run the numbers like three times. 5,000 is what EPA classifies as hazardous waste, mm-hmm. things you find at a mining site.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest lead sample in Leanne's house in a glass of water was 13,000.
Gosh.
So one glass of water contains 2.5 times hazardous waste levels that you find at a mining site.
I really mean this when I say I can't imagine being a parent who, through no knowledge, nothing you did, has been allowing that kind of a threat to your kids. I mean, when you talked with Leanne about this, once you had the results, what did she say beyond the fury that this could happen?
It's, if she is one of the most determined women that you'll ever meet. She's more scientific than more scientists. She is someone you want on your side when you're in a battle. But when she heard the numbers, it really threw her, terribly. And especially, it's one thing. So here's an example. If I give you numbers on the phone and I'm like, this is, really bad, and you feel like, oh my God. But then Miguel wrote his memo, and she saw her entire life written down in a scientific memo.
Yeah.
And that's when it really hit her that, oh my God, these numbers are really, really scary. And I have to, I cannot watch this happen to my neighbors, my city. And that is one of the reasons that, it galvanized her and so many others with her to do what they did.
And so when she learned what this meant, I mean, were you there for some of the decision making? That I guess I'm interested in how this activated her for the mm-hmm. next step. After you've absorbed the shock of something like this, then what? I mean, what do you do to change? It's hard.
Mm-hmm. So the beauty of the grassroots movement in Flint is, the people had been coming together way before Leanne, called us, because the water had turned brown, because it smelled bad,
mm-hmm.
because people were experiencing all these health issues. So you had people were already out on the street protesting. So the groundwork, the strong network of dedicated people, of community leaders and pastors was already there. When the memo got leaked, and MDEQ said people can relax, the water meets standards, Leanne, Melissa Mays, many other residents went to MDEQ's office and asked for, what are you guys doing? And I'll never forget this. One of the officials, laughed in her face and said no one was going to help them. We have confirmed this from multiple places.
Seriously.
So she was in tears at that point, and she called Mark and was like, I don't think anything's going to change. And Mark was like, are you willing to put some work in? And she said, anything and everything. And within a week, we were shipping kits out voluntarily, and the residents were working around the clock to get the kits out to everyone.
Wow. Siddharth Roy is with us. If you just tuned in, he is a research scientist in civil engineering at Virginia Tech. You hear him telling us the story of becoming involved in determining what was contaminating the water in Flint, Michigan. At the time, he was a young PhD grad student in civil engineering that got involved in this, and how that story unfolded. He's part of our This American Moment series, and we're having this discussion on Election Day when we talk with artists and activists and religious leaders and writers and big thinkers about the long view, who we are as Americans, what this moment in America says about us. And as we get a look at the latest news, I want to come back and talk with Siddharth about citizenship. I think we often have a very narrow idea of what it means to be a citizen. And I'm going to broaden that for a discussion, because that means being one another's keepers, right? That means being invested in the health and happiness of our fellow Americans. So we'll talk about that. Siddharth Roy with us this morning. He's a research scientist in civil engineering at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. And he is the guest for our latest episode of This American Moment. Siddharth, I want to talk to you about that idea of citizenship. I think we, you know, in a debate about immigration, we tend to think of it in a very narrow way. But you and the other scientists who stepped into this Flint situation, I think, demonstrate a key obligation of citizenship, which is we are vested in the health and happiness of our fellow citizens. Can you tell me how you think about that?
Well, absolutely. The times I've thought about, you know, our responsibilities to each other, one of the key ideas I pursue or I try to uphold in my work is the goal should be increasing human well-being and reducing, you know, human and animal suffering, you know, to the extent you can. So, you know, science is fantastic because you get to help people, you get to better society. The reason we enjoy such an amazing quality of life, a large part of it is because of, you know, the scientific achievements and other achievements over the past century and a half. So, no matter what your expertise, no matter what your field, I think one of the key obligations is service, is trying to make the world a better place for people around you, for your country, for the world at large. And if you have the tools to do it, you know, that is true privilege.
Didn't you get some advice when you were, was it right out of college from someone who basically said, don't rock the boat?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
Right? What happened with that?
Fond memories.
Okay.
So right out of college, I got a job, and it was orientation, and this you know, managerial guy shows up, and he goes, no matter what you do, you know, be easy to manage. And, you know, at the time, I was this fresh trainee, you know, I wanted to impress people, I was diligent, you know, I'll be the ideal worker, I'll be the ideal trainee. And so I really took it to heart. I'll be easy to manage. But I realized there are consequences if you take it too far. If you see things that are not right, if you see people cutting corners, if you see harm being done, I think, you know, you shouldn't be easy to manage. You should develop the, or at least start working on your moral courage to call that out. So I got over it, but it took a few years.
I think it's worth delving into exactly what you think the person that gave you that advice was saying. I mean, and I assume it was a man. Is that right?
In this case, yes.
Was he saying, hey, you know, you haven't earned the right to really speak up and say things that we don't necessarily want to hear. So just be that person that listens and learns. Or was he saying, hey, corporate America really, I mean, and here's the subtext, corporate America is really the power flows up, and the people that get the right to talk and not be easy to manage are that 1% at the top. I mean, as you think about it now, what else mm-hmm. was he telling you about that?
I think it. Now, this happened in India and not the U.S.
Oh, it happened in India. Well, even more interesting.
But The way I look at it, you know, if I were to play devil's advocate, I think what he was, you know, the noblest of intentions, I think what he was aiming for is, you know, we work in teams. The team's goal is most important. The bottom line, you know, meeting, you know, making sure that our targets are being met, and you know that striving for excellence is not a bad thing. So I don't blame him completely, but I think the way he approached it and telling all young, fresh, you know, all young impressionable minds that do, you know, your team always comes first, I think is was wrong.
So do you think you would have gotten that same advice spoken pretty much like that if you had been in college in the United States and come out of college and you were getting some mentoring advice from somebody?
It's a yes and no. Yes, because, you know, a lot of a large focus of education, especially in the sciences and engineering, is to make you a fantastic cog in a gigantic machine, you know, so that you find your place and you do well, and you know, the engine of the company moves forward. But you also have the privilege of a liberal arts education, and you know that allows you to critically think, to question, to always seek the truth out, ideally. So I think, you know, if you stay true to the principles of what a liberal arts education is, I would bet that people probably will not go all the way with the be easy to manage advice.
That's
what I aspire to anyway.
Right, right.
Yes.
You've also happened into something that I wanted to ask you about, which is this idea that the value of a liberal arts education has diminished because in the United States, we need more people that do what Siddharth Roy does. They're a serious scientist, and we need people that understand technology. What you just said is, even though you are, you know, STEM, right? You're kind of the epitome mm-hmm. of STEM. Mm-hmm. What you've just said says, don't give away the idea of the value of investing in a liberal arts education. Why?
Well, because I think first and foremost, you know, your duty, if you believe in duties, is to be a good person, a good citizen who, you know, hopefully can benefit others while benefiting, you know, himself or herself. So I believe that you know, the fruits of enlightenment are you know, very much present in a liberal arts education. Granted, some of it is getting corroded by ideology and you know, politically correct thinking. But the core mission, you know, still is true. You know, aspiring to be a truth seeker and a truth speaker. And, you know, when you get to the bottom of it, you use that to better society. You make the world a better place. These are, you know, values and principles that are inherent in a true liberal arts education. And, you know, it should stay that way.
What did you mean by politically? It's being corroded by politically correct thinking.
You know, it's becoming harder and harder to disagree with people, especially on college campuses. And you can also see that playing out in the real world. So, for example, if you belong to a certain team, in this case, if you vote blue or if you vote red, if you hear something that is not what your team agrees with, instead of critically engaging, instead of asking why this other person is saying what he or she is saying, instead of probing and thinking and struggling with opinions, I mean, it used to be opinions took time to create. I mean, you'd think, you'd read, it would take months before, you know, you had an opinion, but now just because you vote a certain
or like social media, everybody feels the right to have an instant opinion. And when I hear you describing it took months to develop that event, oh my gosh, that seems so antiquated. And it shouldn't, but it does. Go ahead. What were you saying?
It does. James Gleick, he wrote some fantastic books. He wrote a book called Faster, and which he describes our world. And that was written 15 years ago, but it's so true that it's accelerating at a pace where there's so much information and misinformation and fear-mongering and all this constant sharing on social media. Like, I, there was some statistic, maybe like 50-60% people share things that they haven't read. And I am, you know, I made that up, by the way. But I'm thinking, wait, what happened to struggling with an opinion? What happened to getting to the truth, talking to people that disagree with you? I watch MSNBC and Fox News. I read Breitbart and I read the New York Times. So, I mean, I try, what I'm getting at is people have shut down, you know, speakers are being disinvited to campuses. It's a little bit scary if you think that just because you say something that might cause an emotional reaction, you're not allowed to say it.
You know, here's something else that we were talking about this morning, and what you've just said about you watch MSNBC and Fox and you read Breitbart and you read, what was the other one?
Breitbart, New York Times.
New York Times. Okay.
Well, they're not exactly.
I was going to say,
poles apart.
Siddharth, I mean,
yes.
There is no. It's not one or the other, right? It's not. New York Times is to this what Breitbart is to that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
True.
The other thing that occurs to me and has kind of given me some clarity in this complicated environment that we're in is, I had a guest named Alan Jacobs on the show. This is now months ago. And he wrote this slim little book called How to Think. And one
it's brilliant.
Oh, you've read it. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, last week.
Isn't it good? Did you really?
Yes.
I knew you were a kindred spirit. I love what he says about surrounding yourself with high-quality oppositional argument, right? Choose the high. And he does this on social media, a space where that's really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm,
but he doesn't say, I'll take the lowest common denominator argument and I will try to understand what's been. No, he says, I want the best oppositional argument and I want to understand that and I want to expose myself to it.
It's a lost art, the ability to have a good argument that doesn't get personal because you have a common goal of getting to the truth. You extend a modicum of charity to the other person that they too are trying their best. They might be misguided or you might be misguided, and together we can work towards figuring out what really is going on. So he's right. We should, number one, assume the best in the other people, in the other person, and two, fight arguments with arguments. The words and arguments are all we have.
So how did you happen onto that book, by the way?
I think the Wall Street Journal did a little book review, and then I read the actual book.
I just feel like this could be a national book club, right? What cities do, right, where the whole city reads a book, or the campus? Does Virginia Tech do that, where the whole campus reads a book together?
I think they do at the undergraduate level. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I have heard it's really good.
You're an admirer of Carl Sagan's, right? The astronomer and the writer.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that among the many, many things, what is it that you so admire about Sagan and his contribution to science and, I think, the idea of citizenship?
Well, he embodies, and there are many people, even in current in our current society, who are like him, in that they do prolific science. They're very good, scientific experts at what they do. But they also are able to channel their love for the field and the awe that, what they're doing brings to them, and taking it to children, taking it to schools and colleges and museums. I know Jennifer Doudna, who discovered CRISPR, the technology, who helped, kind of guide the field,
right,
on gene editing. And when you hear her talk, it's just this sense of awe at the universe and having understood a small part of it and trying to share that with everyone. I think Sagan embodies that science is such a universal pursuit, and the more people get a sense of how wonderful and fascinating it can be, the more we can marvel at the universe and try to understand it better.
The other thing that I think Sagan was willing to do, as well as being a stellar scientist and encompassing that awe and wonderment, he wasn't a culture snob, right? He was willing to embrace popular culture. I want you to listen to this clip that I found from the Carson Show, the Johnny Carson Show, 1978. Carl Sagan was on that show many times, and in this interview, Carson is asking him about the science in the movie Star Wars, and Sagan takes it very seriously, and he's troubled by the representation of the creatures in the far-off galaxy. So listen.
It's extremely unlikely that there would be creatures as similar to us as the dominant ones in Star Wars. And there's a whole bunch of other things. They're all white. The skin of all the humans in Star Wars, oddly enough, is sort of like this.
Right.
And not even the other colors represented on the Earth are present, much less greens and blues and purples and oranges.
They did have the scene in Star Wars with a lot of strange characters.
Yeah, but none of them seem to be in charge of the galaxy. Everybody in charge of the galaxy seemed to look like us. And I thought there was a large amount of human chauvinism in it. Also, I felt very bad that at the end, the Wookiee didn't get a medal also. You know, all the people got medals, and the Wookiee who had been in there fighting all the time, he didn't get any medal. And I thought that was an example of anti-Wookiee discrimination.
Isn't that great?
I saw that clip 2 days ago.
No,
oh,
what?
My God.
What do you
oh
mean you
God.
Saw that?
This is too unreal.
This is like, it's like we were, I don't know, teleporting or something into
probably.
Each other's heads. How'd you find, how did you just happen onto that clip?
It was a YouTube suggestion on the side. What's going on here?
Oh, my gosh. You know what I love about that is he's saying something, wow, he's telling a truth, and you can see in the clip, you know, Carson realizes that, and yet he's kind of couching it and having some fun and, you know, being invested in the pop culture conversation, too. God, he's a master. He's just a master.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
I want to grab a call for you here from Chris in Minneapolis. So, Chris, you've been listening along, and what's occurred to you about this conversation?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I've never actually called into a show before, but I was just so passionately curious about kind of a couple of things I'm hearing, and I'm tracking 95% as a liberal arts grad from McAllister, hearing exactly what you're saying and agreeing with most of it. But I wanted to ask a question specifically on the idea that this sort of new political correctness is killing our dialogue. And then I think Siddharth cited the people being uninvited to speak at college campuses.
Yeah.
And the only known examples of that I can think of off the top of my head are people being uninvited due to a concern that they'd be engaging in what we'd consider hate speech. I mean, white supremacists being uninvited to campuses. So I'm just kind of wondering where we draw that line. When we stop saying, okay, this is an okay discourse to engage in and try to understand versus this is just wrong, period. There's no universe in which this could be right.
Yeah. Really good question,
right,
Chris. Glad you called in. First time ever. Good. Sid?
The way I approach it is if I understand that the most prominent cases that have been widely reported are like of Milo Yiannopoulos and a few others, but I have examples of scientists who are facing protests when they're talking about issues that they've understand. Alice Dredger is a sex historian and, you know, an amazing trans activist, etc. And she was, after her talk, there were students protesting because they got an email about how she might be a transphobe. The fact that students don't do, you know, sometimes don't do enough research about a speaker or just go to a talk and listen what this person has to say. If this person is an idiot, you'll be able to, you know, see it for yourself and you can move on with your life. But the idea that words cause, you know, so much damage that and you have to be protected from them, if this becomes more common, you will not be able to survive in a world that is sometimes harsh. The words and arguments are our best tools. And if you see people who using it wrongly or, you know, in an idiotic fashion, you're like, oh, my God, this person is stupid. And you can move on with your life because, you know, your position got strengthened. And if this person made you think, you'd be like, oh, I should alter my opinion. So it's a win-win for everyone in the audience. And I think you should actively engage with people like that. Now, I get it. There might be exceptions. If Richard Spencer comes on campus, I understand. But overall, just being able to keep open ears and just attempt to get this person's point of view, even if it's, if you abhor it, give it a chance. It'll make you a better person. It'll strengthen your arguments. It's a good exercise for you.
Chris, I'll also just add that I was remembering Condoleezza Rice's situation at Rutgers, where she was uninvited to, or I think she pulled out after there were student protests about her giving the commencement speech. So what do you make of Sid's answer there?
No, those are all examples that I hadn't really been familiar with, and I'm glad to hear them. And that seems to resonate with me, that this idea that if they're wrong, it should be immediately apparent to a critical thinker. I still think, though, that the Richard Spencer comment was also valid. I think there's probably two that, on the extreme at least, there is some merit to just saying, no, we're not going to engage with this. And I'm thinking, when you mentioned Breitbart, yes, there's probably some interest to reading some of those articles or seeing what the other side is thinking, but there's also just articles that are just false. They're just flatly wrong.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't give credence to them by saying, that's an interesting idea.
Absolutely.
I mean, the Richard Spencer example is that hits home for you at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. I mean, that's where he, was demonstrating in Charlottesville, and people were invoking his name as they demonstrated, and there was a death in that uh-huh. protest. I mean, what would you say about having someone like Richard Spencer come to campus to spew out his idiotic hate?
Well, I think there was a white nationalist march in Charlottesville, that is when everything went terribly wrong. It was just horrible to witness. I think, oftentimes college administrators have a hard decision to make. If a group invites someone like Richard Spencer, I mean, his ideas as a society, most of us can agree that they're, completely wrong. And so I understand the trepidation that students might have simply because of someone like that coming to campus. But I'd say, give it a chance. If you don't agree with this person, just don't go. It might be that he only finds an audience of five. It's a tricky line to walk. I don't have a perfect answer to that question, except campuses. If there's a legitimate threat, they very well might decide not to engage. But if not, it's actually okay to engage with dangerous, sometimes stupid ideas.
We've been asking every guest for the series for the kind of music that, channels where you think we are in this moment and gives you kind of a sense of inspiration and balance. I loved your four songs, but we're going to play Flogging Molly.
Perfect.
If I ever leave this world alive, tell me why you chose that song, Sid.
It's upbeat. I every time I wake up in the morning, I'm filled with such a strong sense of purpose with the kind of work that I'm doing. There's so much good going on in the world by every objective measure. I understand, things don't seem especially fine in the past 2 years. I understand that. But on every objective measure, the world is so much better than it was 100 years ago, than it was 500 years ago. So I just enjoy the work I do, and Celtic music, Irish folk music gives me that boost. That's why.
Sid, thank you. Such an enjoyable conversation. Thanks for finding the time to do it.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This was a pleasure.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.